Welcome back after a little break. I'm not sure if you know this or not. I think I mentioned it. I grew up in Oregon. I actually went to high school at Lake Oswego High School. I grew up in that area, and it was coming down after I graduated from college to become a counselor at Pine Cove. That's where I met Beverly, okay? But a counselor at Pine Cove, and then I ran into some people from seminary there, Phil Hook and some other ones, caught a bug for going to seminary, got married, and then on December 29th, so Bev and I celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary. Yay! We did that, which was really fun. And then came back down and began to go to DTS and became youth pastor here at Grace. And then later on, my son, Frank, was in Carol's kindergarten classroom. So we've got some link and ties with all that. Which, what was that?
I said we're all connected.
We're all connected. And Carol was the one that informed us. She went to get the kindergartners lined up to go to class. She found my son on top of the refrigerator in the waiting room. So he's an explorer. He's an explorer. So there's a seminary, a school and a seminary up in Portland. It's called Multnomah School of the Bible. And some of DTS people have been there. And I forget the president's name. I think it was Aldrich, but I'm not sure. But he is the one who said that the Northwest, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, that area is the black hole of spirituality. That was the term he gave it. And it's really true. I grew up in high school being called a Jesus freak because I believed, became a Christian ninth grade, lived that faith in a public school, had a very faithful home. But there, if you you can really tell the sheep from the goats in the Northwest. You can really tell. And then we came down to serve at Trinity Christian. Kent Hansen, who was a principal who had worked in Chicago, made the comment that when he came to Dallas, it was harder to tell the sheep from the goats because everybody went to church. So it's kind of that. So you've got a great ministry. It's a beautiful territory, but I understand the challenges and the struggles there, and it's definitely needed. Churches in the Northwest who are living for the Lord stand out, but it's a constant battle with just the ideology that they possess up there. So, well, I hope you all had a great Christmas break. 2 days ago, Bev and I welcomed 5 of our grandkids to let their parents have a time out. I am keenly aware of why toddlers are given to young people.
Yes.
Okay? I built a ramp. I built a racetrack. I built a shooting gallery. Then we had a yogurt bar. And then yogurt bar, not yoga. That sounded funny. Yoga bar? You kid your kids with a yogurt bar. Did all that. And then I was like, okay, what are we going to do for the next hour? You know? So anyway, it was a great time with our grandkids, a great time. One of the unfortunate things, it's something we can overcome, but one of the unfortunate things is that chapter 4 and chapter 5 of Revelation go, they're together, they're one scene, basically. And yet it was 3 weeks ago we jumped into 4, and now we're jumping into 5. So the hard part here is the time that we are covering this has created a gap between the two chapters. But please understand, these two chapters, there is no gap between them. None at all. If you recall, just as a background, we've been looking at this, and the first vision we covered, that was when Christ gave John the information and the message to the 7 churches. And that was Christ's authority over those churches. The angel is challenging each church with their weaknesses, commending them on their strengths, giving them direction, encouraging them to follow certain tactics. And if you recall, most of them say, he who overcomes, or the overcomer. And there's this reward element to living faithfully and for the churches in that area to glean that truth. Okay, and we've gone through those. We finished that. And then immediately in chapter 4, you have this sense of a gate opens, a door opens to heaven, and he is immediately taken by the Spirit into heaven, and he sees the throne room of God in heaven. And he begins to try to describe that to us. He starts talking about 24 elders sitting around a throne, and he who sits on the throne, lightning and thunder. And you just get this majestic, wonderful, glorious picture of heaven with God on the throne. Okay? And it describes it. And then the praise that goes on in chapter 4, the declaration of who he is. He lives forever. He has created all things. All things have their existence and rooted in him, and he's in the center. And it's not a throne room like we would see in the medieval ages that we have in our mind of a long hallway with a throne sitting at the end and the majesty of that. But it's rather he's in the center, and it's key because he's central to everything. He's the origin of everything, and he's right in the middle of that. And so chapter 4 gives us this wonderful setting of what is going to take place, because the focus of chapter 4 and 5 is the scroll and the Lamb. That's the focus. So chapter 4 sets the stage of that, the majesty of it. And remember when we talked about Revelation, we mentioned that John is going to try to describe heavenly images with earthly terms. And they're going to fall short. And when he does that, we are not to take those descriptions as objective elements. That when he sees something as a diamond, it's not really a diamond. He's trying to describe the majesty of what he sees using a limited vocabulary of earthly terms. But yet each of these images portrays some principle. And that's what we're trying to glean from it. And as we mentioned before, oftentimes an image given, we don't have the text telling us exactly what it means. We are having to kind of assume, look at it, and draw from it what we believe might be the intent of it. So we are now in the second section. First vision is authority over the church. This next vision we're coming to is really God's authority over all creation. And chapter 4 sets that stage. And so now we're going to move into our next. As we looked at Revelation 4:1 through 8:1, this is a vision of the seven seals. This is all tied together. They're all linked together. The scroll, the seals on the scroll, and what happens when those seals are broken. So we're in this section on the scroll and the Lamb, setting the stage for those seals to be opened. So if you take your Bibles, we're going to be in Revelation chapter 5. And what I wanted to do, if you remember, if you remember a few weeks ago, Chad, who's not here today, asked about the 24 elders. And I really had not covered those highly. I said there's a lot of views on the 24 elders, and we kind of let it set and we moved on. I thought I would give you a handout that, and believe me, this is not an extensive factual interpretations of what those 24 elders are. But I thought I would give you just some things that are out there. And again, one of the key things I want you to recognize is even though we're not able to identify specifically uniformly on who those 24 elders are, we don't want to miss the majesty of the throne room, because that is the key of it. So on this handout, basically, when I was sitting at my desk looking at this, it was pretty easy to read. I'm looking now, seeing from your distance back there to here, it might be tough, so that's why you have the handout. The question is, are these 24 elders humans or angelic? You know, it doesn't tell us in the text, but it does distinguish. It talks about the angels and the elders. So there's some kind of delineation between the two. You have those who say the use of the white garments. I've given you some references there. The white garments often refer to somebody who's redeemed in text. If we compare it with other texts, the white garment is somebody who's been redeemed. You have the use of crowns, this concept of victor crowns and so forth. We saw that in the previous section in Revelation, as well as the other references I give you there. Crowns are not generally given to angels. We don't have a reference in Scripture of where angels are receiving crowns. So this is some of the outside evidence that they're using to try to determine who they might be. You also have that the angels and the elders are distinctively separate in the text. We have that continuously of the angels doing something, the elders doing something. So there is a delineation. But you also have in Revelation 5, 9 through 10, which you'll see today, that the new song that is sung is not sung personally. It's more of a third person saying, "You have done this for men," which would indicate, well, if it was men singing, wouldn't they be saying it was done for us? So that's one of the other elements that they end up using as part of their determination. Now, if you believe that they're men, let me back up. If you believe they're angels, then basically you're saying that there's just different angels groups in heaven and they are distinctive of each other. That's what your conclusion would be. And this is just another service group of angels that God has created. If you say that they're men, well, then who do these men represent? Some think it represents the nation of Israel, but yet the reference to that is that the nation of Israel is not fully redeemed at the point in this revelation. There's still judgment to come. There's still the 144,000, so it seems that that wouldn't be the group. The other one is the tribulation saints, but then again, you've got the tribulation getting started, so it probably is not them necessarily. And then you have some who say it's the raptured church. And this goes back to 1 Chronicles. When the priesthood was being set up, there were 24 priests that would serve on a regular basis within the temple. That was the way the temple operation would go. And they would, by lot, different groups would go in and serve at different times. So one of the ideas is potentially this could be believers of the raptured church, where there is a group of 24 who are selected at times to go in and serve in this capacity. That's just another one of the possible interpretations of who the 24 might be. The other one is it's a mixed group. They say the 12 sons of Israel and the 12 apostles, the 12 disciples. And it refers to other passages in Matthew and in Revelation and so forth where heaven has the 12 pillars, the 12 gates, all of these related to specifically the apostles, and there's some connection in that revelation. One of the commentaries I read said, well, if it is the 12 apostles, then John may actually be speaking to himself. And you're going to see one of the elders talks to John. I'm giving him comfort today. And so the idea is, well, it could be that. So did John talk to himself? Because John was not in heaven yet, except in spirit. He was still on earth. So I give you this not to give you a conclusive understanding of who the 24 are. Great men interpreted in different ways. And I think what we can take from this is when John gave us this vision, he did not, nor the Lord, felt it was important for us to know exactly who those 24 were. Because the focus of this vision is the throne room of God. But I just wanted to, since Chad had asked, and he's not here today, interesting, but he had asked about the 24, I thought I would at least give you some of the background on those 24, okay? So now we're going to get to our text today in chapter 5. We're going to read 1 through 5. It says, I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a book written inside, and on the book sealed up with seven seals. And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and to break its seals? And no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth was able to open the book or to look into it. Then I began to weep greatly because no one was found worthy to open the book or to look into it. And one of the elders said to me, stop weeping. Behold, the lion that is from the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome so as to open the book and its seven seals. So the attention of this one is the scroll. It's a scroll, it's a book, it has seven seals on it. And John, as he's looking at this throne room, he's seeing this book, this scroll, held in the hand of the one who sits on the throne. And there's a desire for whatever is in that scroll to be known. And it has on it seven seals. The right hand of him who sat on the throne, this is a picture, in my mind, a picture of God's authority over the history of the world. What's in that scroll is going to be outlaying his wrath and what's coming to the history of the world. If we go clear back to Genesis, and you look at the overarching story of Scripture, in Genesis you have God creating the earth and setting Adam on to be his regent to rule the earth. That is his intent. Adam is deceived. Adam places himself on the throne, so to speak. He decides he wants to be like God. And that causes the fall of man, the curse on the earth. But yet, even in the early text, there is one, the seed is promised to come, who will crush the serpent and the rule will be reestablished. And the history of man is between the two bookends. This scroll is beginning to come to the end of the history of man, the history of the earth. And it's held in the right hand of the one who sits on the throne, showing that. So it's that the style written inside and out. Ezekiel 2 refers to this in his vision as well. And I just want to draw your attention. During that time frame, those readers may have recognized an earthly Roman tradition connected to what he saw in the scroll. In the Roman tradition, a will that was passed from one family to the next was to be sealed with seven seals. And it was not to be broken except by the one who had the authority to receive the will from inside. So the seals recognized the importance of what was contained within, the element that the only person who could open that would be the one that was legitimately the benefactor of what was inside. And it was sealed in a way that you could not see what was inside. So you even have in the text, it talks about you couldn't even look into it. You couldn't break it and you couldn't look into it. There was no precursor peek at what might be inside. It was sealed up, kept private, protected and maintained and held in the right hand of the one who sits on the throne. Now, John's response in this, we see, is he is desiring to see what's in the seal, in the scroll. Okay? So he looks at this, and his desire is to have whatever the one who sits on the throne open up and be able to see what is inside. And when there is no one found, it says they look for somebody, and you have this trilogy, if you will. There's no one in heaven, meaning there was no angel worthy of breaking the seal. You have no one on earth, which is there is no man worthy to break the seal and open it up. And there's no one under the earth. The idea here possibly is departed spirits, the spiritual realm. And so as John is looking at this, the desire we get is that they want the seals to be broken. They want the information to be presented. And yet there's no one who can open the seal. And his reaction is to begin to weep. Some believe that his weeping is not only a sadness at the sense that what God desires to reveal is being still hidden. Others believe that he recognizes that this is God's hand in history. He's going to reveal that. And John, knowing prophecy, would know that this is the culmination of the very thing that they hoped for. And the fact that it can't be open is a sad thing. I can't see that culmination. It's going to be hidden a while longer. Because if you recall, the Jewish nation, as well as the Christian church, were all looking for either the coming Messiah or the return of Christ to establish his throne, to establish his kingdom. And John easily could have connected this scroll as the beginning of that history unveiling, that truth being exposed, that historical event beginning to take shape. And when there was no one worthy to open it, he has great sadness and he begins to weep.
Rob?
Yes?
Was there seven seals on this one scroll, or were there seven seals?
I've got an image that's coming up in just a second, and it'll show you an idea. The idea that we know from what we can read is that there are seven seals on the scroll, and each seal broken opens a portion of the scroll. Okay. So it's not the scroll is entirely sealed by seven, because as one seal is broken, as we get into that, as one seal is broken, it reveals something. And then the next seal is broken. So evidently the scroll in some way, his picture, what he's seeing is a scroll that has levels to it.
What is the significance of seven seals?
Well, seven...
Why couldn't it be six or five?
It's seven is that consistent number within Scripture, which points to two things, perfection and completion. And so you will find it seven seals, seven bowls, seven trump. The seven is used repetitively in Revelation, and it is always a sense of completion. This is coming to the complete, full expression of God's. It's going to be God's judgment on earth. And the sevens show that the complete judgment is going to be finished. To go back to seven, we can go back to Daniel when he talks about 7 years of tribulation that complete the wrath of God, that 7 years. And we'll get into how that's kind of divided, we think, within Scripture. But the significance of seven, thank you for asking that. The significance of seven is the completion, the completeness of it done. Creation was in 7 days, that kind of a thing. So it's going to make that connection. So here John is, he's weeping, and you have an elder, one of the 24 elders, basically... be interesting to know whether he politely said it or like what we would say to a crying child that has no reason. Stop your crying. You got no reason to cry. Quit your weeping, okay? But the idea is that he's weeping because he doesn't believe it will be open. And then this elder speaks to him and says, stop crying. Behold the lion. Okay, and this is the introduction of the lion and the lamb. This is the introduction of Christ into the scenario. He's not been presented to this point. Yet the elder says, behold the lion. The significance of the line is we've got titles that are given to this individual connected to the messianic prophecies. You have the one related to the line of Judah. You have the other is the offspring of David. These are the messianic kingly connection to Israel, connection to David. These are fulfillments of that prophecy. And then you have also the promises of salvation that is coming through through the Messiah. And you have that connection. So he, when the elder speaks to John, he gives him all three of those. He connects him to the nation of Israel. He connects him to the lion, to the line of David. And he connects him to the salvation that he has overcome. And we know from other texts, he overcame Satan. He overcame death. And that is what makes him worthy. So he basically is pointing to that we can't find anybody worthy in heaven, on earth, and everything, but that here's the one who is worthy, the lion. Now, he's referred to the lion in this text, but the rest of the text is going to refer to him as the lamb. So whatever John is seeing, he's recognizing both a lamb and a lion. He's seeing both of these in the persona of that individual.
Is therefore the lion and the lamb Jesus?
Yes. It's titles given. You've got different components, but yes. And while this picture gives you both, we need to understand that as John is looking at him, he's getting the image of both of these. He's, you know, here is the lion, but it's a lamb. You know, you've got that connection. Okay? Any questions? Yes, Val.
Is there a connection between this seven-seal vision concept and 7 days in a week? Where did that start? What started?
The Sabbath day was an Old Testament. Saturday was usually the Sabbath, sundown Friday. My understanding, and I could be corrected by anybody that wants to interject that might have a greater understanding of that. Generally, the calendar for the Jewish nation was 7 days. You had the Sabbath day, which was the seventh, and it had its roots in creation. Work 6 days, rest on the seventh. And so it had that foundational to it. Our sense of meeting on Sunday, we generally call that the first day of the week. My understanding is that the early church were Jews. They still went to faithfully serve within the Jewish church on the Sabbath, but then they would meet on the first day of the week for fellowship and other things. That's one of the understandings. Anybody want to add to that? I mean, that's kind of where our Sunday, I think, came from. Gene, our resident theologian.
Seven completed the week. Mm-hmm. So seven becomes the number of completeness just naturally in their mindset. So I think that may be, I think Val's answering Tommy's question. Why is there seven? Because it's the number of
completeness. Yeah.
That's
perfection, completeness, finished work. You work and then you rest and so forth. So
I asked my husband about it. Why is it seven? That's why you don't work on the Sabbath day. Because the whole week you work and on Saturday is the rest.
Yeah, the Jewish element was, and of course if you recall, the Pharisees and the law had a lot of things added to what would be classified as work. It became, you know, you couldn't light a fire. I mean, there were several things added to that. And the Sabbath was, that was their way. And I think rightly so, in the sense they were attempting to keep the Sabbath holy as it was intended to be kept. That was their purpose. It was to be totally other than the other days. It was to remain holy. Yeah. And so anything that was related to work was not to, and you were to give that day to the Lord.
Right. Okay. That's also their prayers for them. We do the prayers for the dead.
Okay, does that get you the seven? You good?
Helps.
All right, good. Yeah, that's all we can ask for, just helping through the process. So now we've got the set. The scroll is there. It's the focus of what John sees in chapter 5. He wants that scroll opened. He desires to see it revealed. It's in God's hand. And then the elder appoints him to the lion and the lamb, the root Jesse. So here is the lamb. 5 through 14, the rest of this text is focused on who the lamb is. The seals are not broken yet, so this is where the lamb is going to be identified. The lion is an image of strong, majestic ruler. The lamb is the image of the meek, gentle sacrifice. You can even go back to Passover. What animal was sacrificed at the Passover? An unblemished lamb. So you've got that imagery in that. We tend to look at the lamb is the first advent of Christ when he comes as the suffering servant, and the lion is the second advent when he comes as the majestic ruler. So you have that component in there. The lamb is the center. Notice he says, I'm going to read this. I shouldn't just do my notes. Let's go to the text, okay? Verse 6, and I saw between the throne with the four living creatures and the elders a lamb standing as if slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, sent out into all the earth. And he came and he took the book out of the right hand of him who sat on the throne. And when he had taken the book, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the lamb, each one holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. I'm going to stop there because what occurs after that is the praise, the new song and the praise. And we're going to look at that specifically. But the lamb himself is one who appears to have been slain. This makes a direct connection. It's unmistakable connection to who Jesus Christ is. There is no way that the reader would go, I don't know who you're talking about. I know exactly who you're talking about. The other thing is, in my text, it says, and I saw between the throne with the four living creatures, and there was a lamb standing. When I read that initially, I thought, interesting, is it beside? When you read it in the Greek, it basically uses the same term as in the center. It delineates the two, but it doesn't say one is standing beside the other. Does that make sense? So the one sitting on the throne is in the center, and the lamb is in the center. And I think that gives us an indication of the unity between the two, the division, but they're both in the center of this vision. So it uses the idea in the center of the throne, the one who sits on the throne, in the center of the throne, and so forth. So the lamb is there. The seven horns within that framework, and if you will, a literary analogy with horns, is that it's power and strength. The seven, again, you mentioned, how does seven fit into this? The seven being the perfection, the completeness. The idea of the seven horns is generally understood as being his complete power, his omnipotence. And then the eyes being his omniscience. It goes to and fro. It sees everything. The seven spirits to and fro. And so this lamb is not only omnipotent, but is omniscient. And that's the imagery that we're getting from that. The idea that the lamb takes the scroll from the right hand of God and he's allowed to take that scroll is identifying his authority and his right to open it, his right to rule, his right to break the seals, his right to bring about exactly what's in the scroll. Okay? Any questions on that so far? We'll give you an opportunity.
It says, and between the throne were four living creatures.
Mm-hmm. The four living creatures, they're introduced in chapter 4, and you have one that looks like a man, one that looks like a beast, one that looks like a lion, am I correct? And then one, the wings. We speculated those four living creatures are around the throne. The imagery of a beast, a lion is a wild beast, the oxen is a domesticated beast, a man, and then the other creatures. The idea is, And they have all these eyes on them to see everything. And it seems as if the beasts are representing the created things, that they're all in worship, they're all connected to the center of the throne or connected to the Creator. If somebody else has something to offer on that, that was just kind of looking at it. It was, what do they represent? We don't have a specific definition within the vision of what they represent other than what they look like. And we can make a connection of what they look like possibly to what he might have seen here, the domesticated animals, the wild animals, mankind, and those who are around the throne. And these four living beasts are in praise of the Creator in the throne room of God. Okay? So he takes the scroll, and when he takes the scroll, praise and a new song begins. I give you the praise, they break out in a new song, and let me read that for you. But the other references I've given you in your notes are other places where when God's deliverance is new and fresh for a specific situation, the psalmist says, break out in a new song. And the idea here is that that seven-sealed scroll is going to usher in a new component, a new deliverance, a new element of what he's revealing. And it calls for those who recognize that to break out in a new song. So it's got that element. Let's look at the song. And they sang a new song. Now, the ones singing this one are the four living creatures and the 24 elders. Worthy are you to take the book and to break its seals. For you... I'm sorry. I'm in verse 9. Thank you. 5:9. I apologize for not giving you that. And they sang a new song saying, worthy are you to take the book and to break its seals. For you were slain and purchased for God with your blood men from every tribe and tongue and people and nation. You have made them to be a kingdom and priest to our God, and they will reign upon the earth. And that's the new song that the 24 elders and the living beast sing. Possible connection is it's the created beings that are being redeemed. The earth is going to be redeemed, and all on it is redeemed by the Lamb. And it's those that break out a new song. Not the angelic host yet, but those break out in the new song when they know the seals are going to be broken. Then I looked and I heard a voice of many angels around the throne and the living creatures and the elders. And the number of them was myriads of myriads and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and might and honor and glory and blessing. And every created thing which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and on the sea and all the things in them, I heard saying, to him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be blessing and honor and glory and dominion forever and ever. And the four living creatures kept saying, amen. And the elders fell down and worshiped. The act of taking the scroll with the new revelation breaks out in a new song, and it culminates in every created being praising God and the Lamb and saying, may their dominion be forever and ever. Okay? If we point out a couple things in the song, it gives us four reasons why this new song breaks out. It lists them. This new song points to the very fact, and one of them is his death, the Lamb who was slain. It says, you purchased a people through your death. Who do we know those people are? Christians. They are those who have come to faith in God by his shed blood on the cross. He was slain, the belief in that, through his death. Creation of a kingdom of priests to God. This is connected to others in the sense that we know that we become his priest, the kingly priesthood, these components and elements related to that of what we are supposed to become as those who are redeemed by his blood. And a future reign on the earth. That is pointed to in the fact that we had that in Revelations. We also have it in several other passages, that one of the things, even in the Gospels, that you will reign with me, you will lead, you will serve, you will judge. Now, I just bring this note because we mentioned about the 24 elders. And this thing, only the 24 elders and the beast without the angels participate in this song. I mentioned that earlier, which might support the conclusion the elders are human or created beings in that, as the song pertains to the experience of the humans and the reason the angels don't participate. That's a possibility, okay? There's a connection that the angels aren't singing in this, it's just the beast, so that's a possibility there. The other thing is declaring the Lamb worthy. That's what you have in 11 through 14, is a declaration of his worth, who he is worthy. You have the entire host of heaven declaring this. And when you try to put numbers on that, myriads of myriads, do some of your texts say 10,000 times 10,000?
Thousands of thousands.
Thousands of thousands. It's as if he says there's myriads of myriads, and when you count all those, there's still some left over, and that's the thousands of the thousands. You know, it's just this massive group of angels that join in. It is interesting, I'll just note this, they give seven expressions which belong to the Lamb. We've seen seven as the complete. We see seven as that component of the complete. And they give seven expressions when they point to the Lamb and they say, power, riches, wisdom, might, honor, glory, and blessing. And again, you'll see seven used throughout Revelation. And then you have all created things join in the last doxology, if you will. Possibly looking forward to Philippians 2:8, where it says, every knee shall bow, every tongue will confess that he is Lord. The last expression, the last doxology is to God and the Lamb of blessings, honor, glory, and dominion. Now, in 4 and 5, you have five doxologies, five components of praise to in the heavenly room. Two of them are related specifically to God in chapter 4, who he is, his reign forever and ever, his glory and everything. The next two are focused on the Lamb, the 24 elders and the beast, their doxology of his worthiness. Then the next one is the angelic host break in, and they declare the worthiness of the Lamb. And then it concludes with the entirety of declaring the glory, honor, dominion of God and the Lamb together. And this is the stage set because what you have in chapter 6, the Lamb now has the scroll. He's been declared worthy in heaven and on earth. Everyone declares his worthiness. And he is going to begin to reveal each level of that scroll. He's going to break the first seal. But he is the only one who can break it. It gives us this sense of God's dominion over history, God's dominion over all created beings, and the majestic, wonderful presence in his throne room and declarations of his worth. Okay? Any questions or comments?